Greetings, dear listeners, and welcome to this week's episode of Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan. My guest today is Tor Verdonk, the Technical Product Director of the Rossignol Group. You've probably never heard of it, but you've heard of the products he has helped to shepherd into the market, most recently the Lang Shadow. The Shadow is unquestionably the biggest story in alpine ski gear this winter. Bear in mind that Lang has been the epitome of the modern race boot for generations of racers. It's probably the most imitated design in the post-war history of our sport. But the Shadow isn't being touted because of its rich heritage, but for the degree to which it has departed from its ancestral roots. A boot design that for many years seemed trapped in amber pulled off the most ambitious redesign of the two-piece overlap shell since this primordial design's inception. We'll talk to Tor about the concepts behind the new Shadow and how he perceives the boot market as a whole in terms of product evolution. It will also be interesting to hear about a career in the ski trade that has spanned decades of involvement with new product development. Tor Verdonk, welcome to Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan.
Thanks, Jackson, for that opening. That was amazing. Happy to be with you guys, with you and the Real Skiers listeners today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you. Let's begin where all ski careers begin, when someone first attached skis to your feet. Where were you when this happened? Where did you start skiing, that is? And how old were you at the time?
I was 4 years old, actually. And a lot of people don't know, I'm actually first generation American. Both my parents immigrated here literally on a boat from Holland. And my dad was originally in Indianapolis and kept seeing ski magazines of pictures of Vermont. So he moved to Vermont with IBM and all about skiing. And he dragged me for my first time when I was four. Apparently I cried for about the first 10 times. And then it was, let's go again. Let's go again.
So thank goodness you had a parent who was willing to drive you over the first hump and keep you in the business. What was your first job in the ski trade?
Well, technically in the ski trade, I was a ski coach after being a ski racer in high school. So I guess in the ski world, I was a ski coach at a place called Smuggler's Notch, the dark side of Stowe, the backside, as we like to say.
And so you were coaching young kids?
I was coaching young kids, yeah, J4s and J1s and 2s after that. And then I started directly with Rossignol after that.
Who were your first mentors or role models as you were coming up in the racing world?
I have to say that my dad was actually a mentor. He was an electrical engineer, and he really taught me how to work on things and think differently. So he is one of my big mentors, I would say, and kind of how my mindset works. And then once I was in the ski industry, a guy named Randy Graves, who ran the race department, who ultimately hired me, was a strong mentor when I started.
So you started out as a coach, transitioned to Rossignol also as a coach, or what was your function with Rossi when you jumped that fence?
When I jumped that fence, it was I moved into what we call the junior race program. So in charge of sponsorships and finding, you know, the next U.S. ski team athletes, the next Olympians. So that was my first role. And that role was amazing. You had a lot of aspects to that role in terms of trying to discover the talent, which is where the coaching background helped. And then this is really where the boot work and the ski work started to happen for me, even though I did quite a bit of that when I was young on my own. But that's where it really started, and had the opportunity to work with amazing athletes from Darren Rawls and Rossignol at the time to Lindsey Vonn, Julia Mancuso, and kind of list goes on.
Rossignol had a huge stable of athletes, so much so that I remember at one point when there's kind of a mini crash, which periodically happens to every brand in the ski industry. I think at that time there had just been a women's World Cup race where the top 10 women were on Rossignol. And if you're paying a victory schedule, that's pretty brutal. So I just wanted to let my dear listeners know that Rossignol, sure, they were in competition with other brands who also had competition services reps, but Rossignol was very much the king of the hill in those days, was it not?
It was. When I first started, it was king of the hill. We had a little rough patch in there, I would say, with the dual tech era, if you recall that kind of put us back a little bit. But that's kind of the part, the ebbs and flows in racing, right?
Sure. I think I first met you at the ski magazine test, where one of your responsibilities was to make sure the skis were immaculately tuned. And I have to say, and I'm not just blowing smoke here, dear listeners, your tunes were instantly identifiable because you had the silkiest turn transition, silkiest ride in, smoothest ride out. You couldn't have done all that by machine. How much hand tuning went into fixing test skis back in the day?
Oh, well, Jackson, that's all top secret. You know that.
It shouldn't be top secret anymore.
I'm kidding. It was top secret at the time, I suppose. You know, coming from the race world, when I came into the marketing side and started taking over that mag test stuff, you know, I had a kind of opinion when I understood how important a top result a mag test was. So I figured it deserved the same kind of energy that the World Cup technicians do just to try to get a World Cup win. You could argue at that time, a magazine result was more important than a World Cup victory in that sense. So I felt like the skis deserved that kind of energy. So there was a lot of hand work, sidewall work and whatnot. I mean, the true secret is that I do use a machine. I use a handheld machine, though it's not one of the bigger machineries, which is kind of what everybody pumps stuff through now.
Do you continue to use your handheld machine?
I do. It was actually a friend of mine and I that developed this machine back in 2006, 2007. So it's a machine I believe in fully. And personally, when you ski on that tune, for me, it's hard to go back. But hand tuning is still something that is an art, and some people can do it and other people struggle a little more at it. I really kind of learned growing up with guys like Eddie Wahlberger, who were World Cup service guys, a Swiss guy, Cookie, who was Peekaboo's technician, Randy Graves at the time, is really where I got my, you know, the basics and the fundamentals of preparing good skis that, you know, to your point, are silky turn transitions.
Certainly you did more than just tune skis during this rather long period you were in competition services. What other jobs did they have you do in between ski tunes? Where else did they point you and say, would you go take care of this? Like, you do have to work ski sales or any of that sort of stuff?
I didn't have to work ski sales at that time. I really was focused on race, but I did a lot of boot fitting, and it's really kind of what developed my critical mind in terms of boots, I would say. And, you know, working with athletes, trying to address issues or wants that they wanted the boot to do this. How could I make, you know, this plastic boot that came out of a mold do more of what they were asking? So it was really, for me, kind of the, let's say, playtime that I had. I thoroughly enjoyed that ultimately, because it allowed me to play and try different things, failing sometimes, succeeding at other times. So I would say that was probably the biggest thing I did during that kind of time frame, was the amount of boot work I did. That slowly led me to where I am today and was more involved in ski development and boot development.
You've been at Rossi for so long that you've seen several regimes, if you will. Two of the more interesting ones have been the reign of Jacques Rodet, which, dear listeners, you don't know this person, but he was a big room personality. He commanded the room. He expected the respect of everybody. He respected, however, almost nobody. I'll tell a Rodet anecdote real quickly to get this part of the podcast started. I can remember lunch in Treviso with a huge press group. This was a giant Rossi intro. They were going to outdo Salomon at introing new product. And boy, did they make a good shot at it. Flew us all around France and down to Italy and all over God's creation. So Jacques has been for almost a week with our group as we're traveling around. We're nearing the end of this extravaganza. We're having this enormous lunch in Treviso, which only the Italians could do. I can remember waving off the trays of duck that were about to come. It's like the fifth course, going, no, we can't do it anymore. We go out in the street and Jacques pulls me aside, and he and I, obviously he's French, so his French is very good, and I was fluent, so he could speak comfortably with me without anyone else in the group really knowing what on earth he was talking about. And the first thing he asked me was, and he used a French expression, which is a complete and utter vulgarity, which I will not use here. But he said, who was the little red-haired nothing that was sitting across from me? And it was Brent Diamond from Powder Magazine who had to have seen Jacques at least three or four times a year to try to get an ad schedule out of the Rossignol brand. He never penetrated Jacques' consciousness for a moment. He wasn't memorable. I tell this little tale because it indicates Jacques' mindset. If you didn't break into that mindset, you remained a complete nobody to Jacques Rodet. Do you have any stories from that era that could sort of help to illuminate a little bit about this this larger-than-life personality?
Yeah, I do, actually. And you're right. It somewhat probably helped me in my career. I'm going to have to use my French accent for this, of course. So we'll see how that comes out here. But I went towards my ending days in the racing side of things, went to Rodet with an idea. After discussing it, he said, "Duh, we can't do this." I said, "Okay." I left the meeting. I said, "I'm not really sure what he said. I think it's a good idea, so I'm going to proceed on." A month or so later, I get a call. "Come in, close the door. Why you do this?" I say, "Jack, I did this because you said we can do this." He said, "No, I said we can't do this. We can't do this. I can't do this." I told him I can't tell the difference between can and can't when he uses his French accent. So this was a funny story that's been told many, many times.
He certainly remembers you more when you cross him than if you simply obey him. That's, I think that's for sure. You also went through an unusual period for almost any ski company in that ownership flipped to a beach brand, Quiksilver, almost overnight. And that was not the greatest of marriages. And you got to see it flip over again. What was it like going through a corporate culture change that was had to have been like, "Holy moly, what the hell's going on here?" And then to see it, in fact, flip back to prior ownership after, only about 3 years, something like that?
Yeah, I think it was 3 years. It also kind of happened right during that economic downturn of, 2007. So that was interesting. It was an interesting time, though. I'll be honest, at the start, everybody was really excited about Quiksilver coming on board. You know, a big, big lifestyle brand with big budgets and marketing budgets. So everybody, you know, had really high hopes. And I think once they got in to the business, hard goods wasn't quite the same as margins or development of shorts and t-shirts. So I think they lost the taste on the hard goods pretty quickly. And then you also had the economic downturn. So they sold off. And, I think for me, it was actually a positive thing when they finally sold again, because at the time they had kind of taken the guts out of the product and had tried to design to value the product as opposed to just building really good products. So when they rolled out, it really opened me up to product development in Europe to get things kind of back on track on skis is what I originally started with.
Oh, so you're part of the ride to the rescue team.
I guess so. Part of a lot of us, I think the vision was much different once Quiksilver had moved on, that we were back to being Rossignol and building good product.
Moving to the more recent past, what were you doing before you took on your current responsibilities? And when did that portfolio pass into your hands? What was that, about 4 years ago?
Well, that history is a little foggy, so to speak. I moved to product management side and product development on the Rossignol side with skis and boots already in 2006. So kind of had been working with the factories. We changed the way we develop product. You know, you spent a lot of time at Salomon. You know how it can go. Sometimes the engineers build the product, then they hand it off to the marketing team and say, "Here you go, go sell it." Now, we really started to take the marketing department, more practical skiers, and put them with the engineers throughout the whole process. So that started already in 2006. And around 2009, 2010, the Lang brand had really kind of struggled. So they'd asked me to come in and help develop the new RS and RX, the first versions of it. That was what, 2008, 2009, we were developing that. And that was actually a fun time because we were missing a product manager, a global product manager. So the R&D team and the engineers, we got a chance to just do what we want and really kind of get back to the basics. So ultimately, my Lang career kind of starts in 2008, 2009, working on that side and then working in product development. Then about 4 years ago from today or so, I took over the Lang brand globally. So I was the global brand manager, and that was present through the start of COVID. And without the travel, that made it a little difficult. So I went back to product development on that side and now kind of head up all the product development for Rosnell, Dynastar, Lang, the technical aspects.
Now that we've established some context, let's get to the breakthrough in boot design that Lang launched this season, the Shadow. When did Lang make the first prototypes of the boot we see today?
We're always trying different things. So when the actual first prototype of Shadow is there is I'd have to rack my memory a little bit. We take sometimes existing product, add on to it and try different things. And we started this already well before COVID, a year before COVID, we started working on the Shadow. Kind of the conceptual part of it started to happen. And we were, let's say, cobbing things together to try to kind of get proof of concept of where we were going. The first real prototypes on snow were probably a couple of years ago.
What was the inspiration for the additional pivot?
Really starting with kind of the goal of what we wanted to do. You know, we had, if you look back when we kind of revamped Lang with the RS and the RX, the RS and the RX were really the same shell. One had removable pads on it on the bottom and the other was a solid sole. And the RX had a little cushier liner. So we knew that when this mold kind of came to its end, that we wanted to attack the kind of all mountain category a little differently, you know, separate the RS and the RX from themselves a little bit. And the goal really moving into all mountain is how could we build product that actually amplified the energy. This was kind of the main concept. Like, how could you get more out of what you put in? And the additional pivots, interestingly enough, came a little farther down the road. We originally started with the blade that goes on the backside.
So how many iterations? I mean, probably impossible to say exactly, but did you have dozens of iterations while you were looking for the right formula, if you will?
Yeah, I would say we probably had dozens or maybe a touch more. You know, development is always is a process, right? And I always like to say success is a process and not an activity. So it's not that you do it once and there you have a success or not. So you keep at it and you keep going and you keep modifying until you get it to where you want. And to be honest, In the case of Shadow, it actually went beyond our expectations even, which is always a fun one.
So the force amplification was the target you were trying to hit when you succeeded. What were the other targets that you, in the process, turned out to hit as well?
Of course, fit, right? We know that ultimately, I call it the Pepsi challenge, is ultimately how people buy product, right? On the sales floor, right? Where you're not going dynamic with the boot. Being a Lang, we knew I had to ski, right? So we wanted to have the technical attributes and story behind it. But we also know that fit was super key in that sense. So, you know, you're always kind of developing conjunction. You're working on the technical aspect and you're as well working on the fit, which is, to be honest, the shell is relatively easy to get with the fit. It's the liner that liners typically take us a year and a half to 2 years to totally perfect in a model.
Wow. And you were working with a new material with the Auxetic liner, right?
Yeah, Auxetic is super interesting. If you're ever really bored or any of your listeners are really bored and you search Auxetic technology, it will kind of blow your mind. It works kind of opposite what you would think. If you take a rubber band, for example, and you stretch it, the middle of the rubber band gets narrower. Auxetic is really done by the geometric shapes that you cut into it, that when you were to pull that material, it actually expands. And we thought that that would be an amazing kind of concept to bring into a liner, or even the external material of the liner, the padding, what it may be. So we went through a lot of different versions of this auxetic type of material. You're starting to see that auxetic come out a lot in some clothing and footwear and whatnot. So it's starting to become more and more out there in the kind of general market.
Certainly a ski boot is one of the more exotic places to try to put any product, because it's under an awful lot of stress inside a ski boot. Not to mention what it may be subjected to just during the fit process. Before going into more detail on auxetic and the different role being played by the shell and the inner boot, or the complementary roles, I might say, between those two elements, there had to be a good foundation for it already. And to me, the foundational technology that preceded Shadow was dual core, or the multi-port injection system that you've introduced. What was it, is it a decade ago now? I think that's too long. It's probably more recent than that. But didn't that have a profound effect on the performance characteristics of your shells even before you got to the Shadow shell design?
Absolutely. I mean, you're talking to a complete boot geek nerd here, and my personal opinion is dual core is one of the greatest innovations in plastics in the last 30 years. We've seen a lot of lightweight plastics and other types of moldable plastics, what you may have, but being a little more of a traditionalist, I believe a ski boot has to be alive, right? The boot itself, structure-wise, but also the material it's made of, has to absorb and release energy. And that's important for putting power down to the ski, but it's also, and a lot of people forget this part, it's also your feet are the only thing connecting you to your spatial awareness of where you are in space. And so it's the feedback, that elasticity of the plastic gives you the feedback to let you know what the snow condition is. Am I rough? Am I nervous here? Or am I solid? Am I planted? The traditional polyethers and polyurethanes have that elasticity in its truest sense, but dual core was taking that multi-port injection concept and being able to inject, let's say, a softer durometer of plastic directly in the middle, so sandwiching by two layers of rigid material. So now this created a mechanical, so to speak, compression and tension happening on the plastic. So it even enhanced that feeling and touch that you had in the boot more than just raw polyurethane or polyether.
I don't think a lot of skiers appreciate the fact that what you are buying when you get a new boot is a fresh new product that has not yet lost its elasticity. That in fact, this elasticity is the product that aging in the shell eventually kills. Would you agree that people maybe over-ski their boots in terms of their life expectancy because they expect the sole to actually wear through before the boot's no good? How many days can the average skier be on a boot before we actually see a decline in the responsiveness of the material itself?
You know, I don't know if that's ever actually been measured in a laboratory. I would say 150, 200 days. I mean, if you're really an avid skier and you want to get everything you can out of the boot, I would say it's 150 to 200 days. Could be longer than that. I mean, the plastic definitely does dehydrate in a sense. So you do lose some of that elastic property. I mean, I think traditionally most people can get away 4 or 5 years with a pair of boots if they wanted to. But if you're an avid skier and I think you want all of the advantage you can get, a couple of years probably makes sense to replace your boots.
Yeah. But it's the death of the elasticity which signals the death of the boot, wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, that and probably the liner at that
point. Oh, that's true. The liner, of course, especially in the hands of a guy. Yeah. Stinky guys will wear it out. Were you consciously trying to create a fit environment that was virtually independent of the technical properties of the boot? This classic separation of the properties of fit and function that go back to the old Salomon rear entry days, where we had a very clear delineation between those two functions. Do you feel that that's in play here with the shadow?
To be honest, it kind of came to us as a surprise, Jackson. Guiding light for us at Lang has always been this concept of where fit and performance meet each other, right? Where the marriage makes sense. For me, the statement I've always said is performance is nothing without fit, and fit is nothing without performance in that sense. And this has been a guiding light for Lang in that sense. And basically what I mean is you could have a marshmallow boot and you're not really going to enjoy your day because you can't control anything. Or you can have the opposite, the race fit, and you know your feet are killing you and you've got all the power and precision. You're still probably not enjoying your day as an all mountain skier in particular, right? So it's really trying to find that marriage. So we're always focused on that. This one really kind of surprised us, is that when we kind of changed this structure and took a different perspective on how a boot functions, we were able to discover that we were able to go more generous in the fit without losing any of the performance.
Interesting. Certainly part of what gives the shadow its unique fit properties is how the cuff and the lower shell are connected. You don't have the classic double screw rivet in a vertical formation on the connecting the cuff to the lower shell and the spine of the boot. Describe what makes the shadow spine work without these rear rivets. Is the cuff to lower shell connection more dynamic as a result?
Exactly. It is more dynamic. So if you look at the way boots have been built traditionally for, I don't know how many years now. Yeah, I mean, literally almost since Bob Lang's first plastic boot, you have a hinge rivet and you have two fixed screws on the back. And those are in really close proximity to each other, right? As you flex around a pivot, all that force is going to those two screws. That's ultimately where you drive the boot. We wanted to create a longer lever arm. Obviously, this is kind of the simple machines concept of a longer lever, you get more power. So by taking out the two screws in the back, and the blade is really what does that. And if you see a picture of how the lower shell is, that blade is actually connected to the lower shell, molded with the lower shell. And now the cuff slides in between the back of the shell and the blade. So now the blade comes all the way to the top where we connect it with an elastomer, and that whole blade is allowed to have some free movement. So there's no kinking. So it's a really smooth, continuous flex as the lower and the upper interact with each other.
But there's still substantial resistance there. When you flex into a 130, you find the bottom of that range pretty quickly.
Absolutely, you do. And that's, we say that the two technologies work together. So, and this is really kind of where the mountain bike suspension analogy comes from. And it was really when the dual pivot came into the picture, because we originally started with only the blade and we were finding that the boot was almost too powerful, and because you only had kind of one force point. So when we added the dual pivot down below, now you truly create what we would call a rocker style of system, where you have a pivot point and you have compression and tension happening both above the pivot and below the pivot. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Okay. So the cuff and the shell working in coordination, if you will, is part of the reason that you're able to get so much power transmission with a relatively short elastic travel.
Correct. Yeah, it's kind of the law of leverages and creating the simple machine of the leverage point, but then having a cause and effect happening on both sides of the elastomers, right? The dual pivot is a little misunderstood in the sense that that pivot is not a fixed point. It's actually encased in an elastomer as well. So if you can think of a rockered mountain bike suspension, you have a pivot point, you have a shock absorber on one side, which is putting pressure back to the rear wheel to keep it on the ground and absorbing bumps. But the rear wheel is also a force point, right? So that it wants to absorb the terrain or push down. So you've really kind of got this cause and effect around the pivot. You got something, a compression happening at the top when you have a tension happening at the bottom.
So it all works as an ensemble. In other words, you had to build the spine the way you did in order to find the location, if you will, of that second pivot point.
Exactly.
And did the oxetic liner, did that move in tandem with the shell? Were there times when the shell development was ahead of the inner boot development? Did they eventually reach the finish line at the same time? Or is there a chicken and egg here? Or are they both moving somewhat together?
Well, they move together when we get a little farther into the process. You know, the shells and the molds, and to make the molds and the prototype molds takes longer. So you initially start your shell development before the liner. They kind of happen in conjunction. But then as you get farther into the project, again, I mentioned that I think what the thing that we spend more time on in development is the liner than the shell. Actually, ultimately, they work at the same time, but it takes more time to get that liner completely dialed in. So your answer is they were in conjunction, but the auxetic came in kind of in the middle, to be honest. It was a new idea that we kind of saw having some effect in some other industries, and we thought it made sense to give it a try, with great results, actually.
It must have been an eye-popping experience because, ladies and gentlemen, Lang's history in inner boots is not a glorious one from the comfort standpoint. Not a lot of people will say, oh my gosh, my Langs were so comfortable. Everyone bought Langs for the performance, and you kind of lived with whatever comfort you were able to extract from the design. Here you have something completely different. You have a inner boot that is so comfortable, you look at the side of the boot again and say, "That why it does say Lang in the side. What's going on here? This isn't just a more comfortable Lang inner boot. It's the most comfortable inner boot I've ever put on my foot."
Well, I think you hit it on the head earlier. We were able to go more comfortable because of the structure of the shell and how that delivers the power. So we were able to even kind of get more comfy in that sense. So I think you're correct there. I do think that we're not your father's or your grandfather's Langs anymore. And I think that's been the case since really the first RS and RX. I think we made some drastic improvements, but we still live with that Lang, Lang shin bang, Lang brutal liner fit history, I suppose.
I think you're in the medical literature for the Lang bump, which is a retrocalcaneal exitosis, is actually referred to as a like a mark of distinction as a Lang bump. Would you agree, just sort of in summary, that the principal difference in the shadow versus the earlier Lang designs is how the shadow responds to forward flex from the skier standpoint? I mean, it's what you get out of that primordial move forward that's so different, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, that was the goal, right? Going back to how can we build a boot that assists the skier to put more in than you get out, than you get out more than you put in, right? This was our goal from the start. So I would agree with that.
You know, that's coming at a great time for me because it turns out over time, I'm not getting younger. So the ability to generate more power with less effort is music to my ears. Turns out that I'm part of a generation which still supports this industry. There's no segment of the population that has more dough or more time or more inclination to go skiing a lot. So I think introducing this particular design at this time with the aging ski population, boy, it's like the cavalry riding to the rescue. You don't have to get into a rear entry mush bucket in order to feel comfort. You could have a precision fit and precision performance and not give up anything on the comfort front.
Yeah, I mean, I think, to be honest, all mountain skiers, I mean, if we're all honest with ourselves, we all want to ski better, right? We all want to experience more. We all want to increase whatever we're doing. We want to increase that enjoyment that we get out of it. So to me, I think it's, the way you just explained it, for sure, it's a great help. But I think any all mountain skier wants to be able to ski longer in the day or just get more out of what they are experiencing.
Amen to that. You've established a line now where in terms of flex indices, men have a choice of 110, 120, 130, which I think is a good, covers the needed range, and women's go from 85, 95, 115. That strikes me as almost an ideal model mix in terms of flex index. Do you have any plans on changing that or expanding in either direction?
No, I think particularly in shadow, I think that that one is viable and makes the most sense. The ability to adjust this shadow boot to me was kind of a, in testing, was an aha moment that sometimes you get in testing, where traditionally, if you were to buy one of those flexes and you wanted to make it softer, you normally remove a screw or cut the medial lateral sides down. And ultimately, you're changing the mechanics of the boot when you do that and how the force is distributed. With the shadow, with the elastomers in both the dual pivot as well as the top of the blade, we're able to adjust those elastomers to get a softer flex, but it also changes the power delivery and keeps the mechanics of the boot consistent, but allows the power distribution to be more, let's say, manageable. How I kind of relate that to is like a car that has the sport mode and then the eco mode. The power comes on really strong and quick, or you can adjust that power to be a little bit more forgiving and manageable.
I imagine that many, if not most, of my dear listeners know that both Lang and Rossignol are part of the same collection of brands that also include Look and Dynastar. Will we see Shadow migrating across the brand boundary into Rossignol, or will the design remain solely with Lang?
No, that design will remain totally with Lang. I mean, we have a lot of people that work on both products, such as myself, and we have some engineers that work specifically to keep the two brands, you know, kind of unique, and actually allows us to bring more ideas out to the market than let's say a singular brand, because we have two avenues to take that those technologies to. So, but this will be purely a Lang technology.
Is there any point in the two brands, this is Rossi and Lang, their model lineup where they share technology? Is there any place from racing down to entry level where the brand distinction is kind of evaporates, or is there always a difference throughout the line?
The only place we share technology is in racing, and really it's due to the market size in racing boots. So your RS and your Hero are the same molds. We use the same technologies in different colors. That's the only place where the two brands share a boot.
Didn't Rossi, by the way, recently change the location of the hinge rivet on the high-speed models in that line? In other words, you did do some tinkering with pivot position in the Rossi line, just not the same way as you did with Lang?
Yes, no, the Lang hinge position is quite similar to what our RS and RX was, where in the high speeds, we moved that differently in that sense. And that was a move from its last boot, which was just before the high speed. But yes, we did change the hinge rivets on the high speed as well.
The other big new item in alpine ski boots is certainly not new to the world of snow sports, but BOA, which is a cable-driven internal fit system, has been introduced, I think, in the initial year by four different brands to varying different degrees. With Atomic, it was just one model. What's your take on the limits, if any, of BOA's system versus Buckle's?
Well, I actually think BOA is relatively interesting in some ways. To start off, I would say the BOA definitely, at this point, at least what we've seen so far in the market, you do create a one fit zone kind of concept, where Buckle's, you still have the option of the two fit zones. If I want my instep a little looser, my toes a little tighter, I have the ability to adjust that, where the BOA makes it a singular fit zone. I think there's room for improvement to make that kind of more consistent in the future. If we really break it down, it's simply a closure system, right?
Would you be open to adopting BOA if you had control over how it was integrated into your shell and cuff and inner boot designs? In other words, it wasn't something you stapled onto an existing design, but could sort of integrate it from ground up?
I think if we can put it on a boot where it helps whatever construction or technology we're building it with, I think absolutely we're open to it and potentially could be there. Ultimately, as you kind of mentioned, right, we'd have to have kind of that control over how we would execute on that. And to me, it would have to provide inclusion of the technologies that we use in conjunction with it.
Some of my concerns around BOA are that in the eyes of a skier who's new to the sport, it may seem like, well, what do I need a boot fitter for? I've got a bow on there. I just turn the dial, and when I get the right comfort level, I'm done. What is it? Do you see BOA as potentially making it easier for people to see themselves self-serving their boot fit, even in a, either in a store by just boots on the wall? I go find the box and put it on as you would buy a sneaker at a big mall store, or some other way of trying to, you know, simplify the whole process of fitting a boot.
I don't see it replacing boot fitting. I mean, in the end, a plastic shell is a plastic shell, right? You have limitations there, and the liner becomes really the most important part. And ultimately, boot fitting done properly, in my opinion, is about pinpoint boot fitting, right? It's a navicular, it's a six toe, not making the whole boot bigger just for one or two small spots. Obviously, footbeds are still a really key part to the basic foundation. So I don't see BOA as replacing the boot fitter. For me, again, it's a closure system. It's an interesting closure system that you can get a lot of tension on. So I suppose some people may believe that you could just keep cranking it because you do have a lot of power in that BOA. But ultimately, you're going to have some limitations in terms of how the foot interacts in the shell. So I still think the pinpoint boot fitting is the kind of the key portion to getting your setup dialed in right.
And that may not always be compatible with the path of a BOA cable.
Yeah, sometimes. I don't really see the BOA as being an issue in terms of the boot fitting itself. Everything I've seen, you've been able to do more or less everything you can with a buckled boot, to be 100% honest.
Okay. One market segment that's been overserved, at least in my opinion, in recent years is alpine touring. In other words, we'd call it backcountry skiing, not non-lift assisted. Do you see the market for hiking and or hybrid boots that are both a little bit in resort, a little bit out of resort? Do you see that market growing or shrinking?
This is an interesting conversation. Ultimately, you know, it depends on what boots you throw into this category that you mentioned, right? Like ultimately, there's so many different usages when you talk touring or kind of hiking boots, right? I mean, if I give you an example, I look at road bicycles. You have time trial bikes, you have climbing bikes, you have aero bikes, triathlon bikes, cross bikes, gravel bikes. I mean, touring bikes, put panniers on. I mean, they're all road bikes, correct? But they all have different, slightly different usages, even though they're all different road bikes. So I kind of see the alpine touring market like that. You have kind of the, let's call it the side country guy. I've never totally loved that term, but the side country guy, you've got the guy who just is going up because he wants to go down and ski like the cool stuff without anybody around. And then you've got the guys who are out there doing it for exercise, and you've got the real billy goat guys who just want to go way back out. You know, I'm not sure if that's about skiing or just being outside. So all in all, I think COVID, we had this huge boom in kind of touring. In that sense. And I think we have seen it slow down. And we've also seen some slowdown in kind of this do everything boot, more towards maybe what you're talking about is kind of the side country boot.
I just think that the segment as a whole has been overserved, given that climbing uphill is, wait for it, hard. It's just the average guy on the lift is taking the lift because he's not fit enough to climb it, among other possibilities. So
I agree with you. I like to say I'm a descender, not an ascender.
Switching gears, one of the underappreciated foundations for any brand success, I think, is continuity in management. You've been working with pretty much the same core of R&D athletes, analysts, engineers, skiers, whatever nouns you want to attach to them, this core group of people that are testing your prototypes, that's been a pretty consistent cast of characters over the years, has it not?
It has been. I mean, I would say a lot of these Italians and French guys have become close friends, brothers in a way. We almost, you know how each other think, and kind of I can ski a product and know exactly what one of my other guys is going to say in terms of feedback. So it's that kind of gelling has been kind of, I think, amazing for our brands, both on the ski and the boot side.
Well, hats off to them, because their faithful execution of their duties has resulted in, certainly in the Shadow, an absolutely stunning product. Looking at the global market picture, and I realize that you're a product guy, not a numbers guy, but you have to be aware of what's going on in various different markets. So it's not like you're designing your stuff in a cave. You're aware of what's going on in marketplaces. What we're seeing in skis is fewer skis are being sold, in part because demos are ever more accessible and Vail's introducing a new program that should make it easy. I don't know how they're going to do it logistically. Sounds like a nightmare to me, but you can go to any resort and they'll have the ski you're waiting for in your size ready to go and at an affordable price, so that they're once again sort of end running the specialty retailer in order to outfit a skier, in this case with skis. My question to you as a boot developer, is the boot market ever going to get potentially this close to being a self-service, pick your own ski, but never even have to buy a boot in this instance?
I don't really see that. I can see it in skis a little bit. I think North America is still pretty well balanced in terms of retail sales versus, demo rental type of stuff, where Europe is a little bit the opposite of what, let's say, North America is. But in boots, I mean, boots are so personal, right? Ultimately, in the end, you can be on slightly the wrong ski and you can still have a nice day out there. But if you're in the wrong boots, man, we all know how miserable of a day that can be. Those are the days you end up at the coffee bar or the real bar earlier than you should be.
So where is Europe compared to America? We might call the service spectrum. Can the Euro skier easily get a demo ski wherever they go? Is the barrier between them and being comfortable with a demo ski a smaller jump than it is for an American?
I mean, I would say that North America it used to be like 80-20 retail to rental. It's probably shifted more like to 70-30. I think the different usages of skis now that you didn't have, let's say, 30 years ago. So if I did make a trip out west, if I was an East Coast person and, you know, it snowed one day or it didn't snow the last week where I could choose skis, that kind of makes some sense. I think in Europe, Europe is interesting to me. I mean, I believe that in both North America or in Europe, if you're really truly an avid skier, you're purchasing your product, right? You want your tunes set up the way you have them. You want your boots set up the way you have them. In Europe, I think there's a lot of people, you know, from the Netherlands or Germany or whatnot, that are going to experience the mountain. And for them, I think the demo program or rental program works well for them to get outside and go out and experience the mountains. I don't know if that directly answered that question.
Well, I think it's a fuzzy question, which deserves a fuzzy answer. I'm just sort of leery of the whole internet taking over everything and what we lose when that happens. And when I see the world of the boot fitter shrinking to the point where all he can really do is fit boots or tune skis, but he loses control of the sale at the end, which the profitability from which is pretty important to staying in business, I worry about where the business then evolves. Do people end up having the level of service available to them that they currently have, but they may not have tomorrow?
I still think the boot side of things are going to stay relatively personal. I mean, ultimately for me, it decides if you have a good day or a bad day in boots. So one or two bad experiences on the boot side of things, whether you're progressing as a skier and the boot just isn't giving you enough, or whether the boots hurt and whatnot, and then you go see a boot fitter and you realize what they can do. I always joke that not a lot of people say, hey, you got to go see my ski guy. But how many people do you know in this sport that say, you got to go see my boot guy? He'll set you straight, right? It's like kind of with your car, like you got to go see my mechanic. This guy is good.
Well, whatever the future may hold for the ski market as a whole, the present belongs to Lang Shadow. I imagine that the figures for preseason sell-in, again, not your domain, but I imagine that the figures for preseason sell-in would probably indicate your biggest new product launch since the overall boot market sort of shrank in the early 90s, which I think is quite a feather in your cap. So, Thor, you have my sincere congratulations for a job very well done. and my undying gratitude for being my guest today on Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan. And to all my dear listeners, thanks for listening in.
Thanks. Pleasure to be with you.